Welcome back to Hoops HD, everybody. We have a very special podcast this evening. I'm your host, Chad Sherwood, joined by a pair of Hoops HD regulars here at David Griggs and John Titel, audio only this evening. We've got a very special guest tonight, the NCAA Director of Media Communications and Statistics, David Warlock. David, thanks for joining us, first of all. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well, guys. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. And before we get going into our actual discussion, I just wanted to, for anybody out there that doesn't know you or not familiar with your position there, and it's an interesting title, Media Communications and Statistics, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do for the NCAA?
Sure. So I'm the director of the Media Coordination and Statistics team, and our staff, there's 15 of us total. We do all the statistics for all the sports, divisions 1, 2, and 3, men's and women's sports, during the fall, winter, and spring on a day-to-day, night-to-night basis. We collect all the game files from all the different schools, whether it's football, field hockey, volleyball, soccer, in the fall, basketball and hockey in the winter, and then baseball, softball, lacrosse, on and on and on. And so we do all those statistics every day, track records, statistics manuals and interpretations. And then we also, the other half of our job is media coordination. So we oversee media operations for our 90 championships for the NCAA. We're on site for probably about 24 of those, the ones that attract the larger media contingencies. And so I oversee that group, but me specifically, the sports I'm most involved with would be FBS and FCS football from a statistics standpoint, and then media coordination for Division I men's basketball. So I oversee, you know, all the press conferences and coach and player availability coordination during the tournament. I work with Dan Gavitt, our vice president for men's basketball, and his staff, along with the Division I men's basketball committee, and handling all media opportunities with them, helping them with the selection process. And I get to sit in the room and assist the committee with the selection, seating, and bracketing process, which is probably my favorite part of the job. That sort of thing. So handling the credentials, credential requests, media inquiries, that sort of thing for D1 men's basketball.
So when do you sleep?
I do in the summer, but now with two kids, I'm coaching Little League and that type of stuff. But no, it's during basketball season. It's awfully busy, but it's definitely a labor of love, and so yeah, I don't mind the work at all.
Right, and Dave, I'm under the impression that you've kind of been involved in sort of, I don't know, or have you been sort of the event planning? Because it just seems like in the last 15 years, not that, I mean, the NCAA has always been a big extravaganza, but now the Final Four, it's in a football stadium, it's sold out, there's as many people, if not more, outside watching on like the Jumbotron, and there's all these events tied to it. You know, have you played a role in that and just building it up into, like, it's a huge event, all rivaled by almost nothing other than perhaps the Super Bowl?
It is, and you know, I am fortunate to play a bit of a role. I started working on the men's basketball championship in 2006, and while the event certainly was big then, just what it is today, it's so much more than two games Saturday, one game Monday, handing out a trophy, shooting some confetti and leaving. It's turned into, right, as you said, just a huge, just extravagant event. And yeah, there's things for everyone, including people who don't particularly care for college basketball. Obviously, a big chunk of what we do caters to the college basketball fans like yourselves. But there's also family activities and concerts that, you know, our partners from Toronto PBS are largely responsible for. Getting these acts that are free to the public. And so, you know, I just think about some of the acts we've had, you know, through the years, you know, whether it's, you know, hip hop like LL Cool J or pop like Taylor Swift and Maroon 5, or, you know, cult type followings like Jimmy Buffett, or rock fans like Kiss or Slash, yeah, what have you. We have all these big events, and they're completely free. And
Yeah, KISS was at the Final Four. That's sort of, wow, that's just amazing.
It is, and it's just, you know, it allows people who don't have tickets to the game to experience, get in on the fun. We might announce that a band is performing, and if you're in a reasonable drive, you might come to the Final Four city to see your favorite band and take in some of the atmosphere and some of the family activities that are very cost friendly or in many cases completely free. And you know, obviously having a ticket's nice too, especially for the fans. And we moved into, you know, these large stadiums beginning in 2009 when we were at Ford Field in Detroit, and we've pretty much had 70,000 or a little bit more at the Final Four and at the national championship every year since then. And I get why there's some criticism over that, because you're playing in such a large venue. It's obviously a basketball game. But at the same time, there's certainly demand for it because people want to experience it. And most importantly, we survey our membership, including the players themselves, and see what their take is on it. And, you know, they definitely like it. And so, you know, for the foreseeable future, you know, right, we'll see these type of formats.
I got to say, I kind of am a fan of it, largely because it's something that if your team gets there, your school gets there, you have a reasonable chance to get to go now, because there's 70,000 tickets. So it might take some grunt work, but back in the days when it was in arenas, it was a little harder to get to sometimes. And even if you can't get into the game, there's another 70,000-80,000 or more outside watching on the Jumbotrons. So
absolutely. And it's, you know, the tickets have remained, you know, pretty reasonable. If you're fortunate enough to get one at face value, you can get something in the mid 400 range for a good seat. And that's not per game. That's for all three games. And so if you compare that to Super Bowl, but even something like a Stanley Cup playoff game, you're going to spend $150 for a single game. And that might not be a Stanley Cup. That may be the second round, for example. So I think we've kept the prices, you know, pretty reasonable. And I compared to other events of this magnitude, the general public has a better chance of getting a ticket to a Final Four rather than, you know, say a Super Bowl or an NBA Finals.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, Dave, I think one of the neatest things that you've just said a few minutes ago about your job is being in that committee room, because I know I know a lot of college basketball fans out there, and I think John, who's on the call with us, also would agree that's one of the most interesting things as to, and there's so many of us out there that are trying to guess what that committee is doing. So can you just, you know, what is that like being in that room?
Yeah, I always say, you know, I've been fortunate enough to be in the room for, if people call it Selection Sunday or Selection Weekend, we're really in there for 5 or 6 days. You know, the committee is certainly in there, you know, for 5 days. I usually get in on Monday or Tuesday to start some of the prep work. But I always say it's like Christmas to me. I love it. I'm fascinated with the process. I think, you know, it's, I just love college basketball. I love the fact that there's all these games going on during the conference tournament during that time, and there's basketball beginning at noon Eastern time, and it goes until well past midnight. And while we're not watching them, you know, all the time, the fact of the matter is, you know, those conference tournaments are going on. There's plenty of excitement around them. The games are very meaningful. A lot of those teams are trying to earn automatic bids and things. And then just the process itself, being with the committee and listening to the discussion, having the opportunity to contribute to the discussion with fact-based statements and facts, or stats, I should say, about, you know, about the teams and watching them go through the process. And part of what makes March Madness great is Selection Sunday. And no matter what tools you have at your disposal, there's always going to be critics of the committee in terms of which teams are selected or how teams are seeded. And we get that. And that makes it, that's part of the fun. And it's, we'll never have a situation where everyone just nods their head in agreement. Going, yep, I agree with everything.
Yeah. I was going to say something real quick, and I think we all know this, but just so the audience can hear it, it is more, you said 5 or 6 days. I don't think people realize it's actually a season-long process. Like opening night, I think each committee has two or three, it's actually three conferences that they sort of monitor, and they report to each other all throughout the year. So it isn't like they are looking at the data for the first time when they get in the committee room. I mean, this is a well-educated committee. They watch games all year long, and what's happening in November is discussed, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. And starting with the season beginning November 6th this year, and you're exactly right. Each committee member except for the chair, so the other nine committee members have 3 to 4 conferences.
Well, I actually did not know that. Thank you. I didn't realize the chair didn't think. I just learned something. Wow.
Yeah, the chair is like more in an oversight role. But the other nine committee members have 3 or 4 leagues for which they're the primary monitor, and then another 3 or 4 for which are the secondary monitor. So in total, you have, you know, about 7 conferences per committee member, you know, that they're serving as a monitor. And so they're tracking on these teams, watching teams, having regular communication with the commissioner and the associate commissioner with men's basketball oversight to talk through these teams. We get reports from, you know, one coach from each of the 32 conferences, mm-hmm. to kind of get their take on who are the strongest teams in their respective regions. And then we have all sorts of feedback based on statistics and based on analytics and that type of thing. And there's a lot that goes into it, and you're exactly right. It becomes a daily grind from November on, and every game means something. You know, nothing gets on my nerves personally than people saying these games are meaningless, because it couldn't be any further from the truth. Now, yes. A lot can change over the course of, you know, 4 or 5 months, and teams get better as they play more games, and certainly there's injuries that can be overcome and that sort of thing. But every game does have is impactful in terms of scheduling and results, and when it comes time to March, and we're not just evaluating how a team did in the last couple of weeks, but it really is an evaluation based on, you know, 30 something games.
And I know we got John on the call here also. John is one of the premier, actually nationally, people are guessing what the committee's going to do. John, I don't know if you want a few questions on that topic also.
I do. I kind of want to talk about KISS for an hour, but I will jump right into that. So, David, thanks again for joining us. In terms of the committee, one of the things that I'm concerned about is scoring margin. I believe that with the new tool, NET, it's capped at 10 points a game, which I understand you have to draw a limit somewhere perhaps. But my question would be a hypothetical situation where two equally matched teams, team A is, let's say they're both up like 15 points in the final minutes. Team A kind of takes their foot off the gas. Other team, the opponent cuts it to single digit, and they have to struggle just to get it back to 10 points for the win, while team B is up 15 in the last few minutes, and they step on the other team's throat and end up winning by like 29 points. Are you saying, or is the metric that I'm reading about accurate, that those wins are treated the same?
Well, they're treated the same in that, you know, the scoring margin, like you said, is capped at 10 points, and so there will be, you know, a greater reward for winning by 10 points than there is for winning by 1 point. And there will be the same reward for winning by 14 points as opposed to winning by 28 points. But if over the course of time a team has numerous wins by 20-plus points, subjectively the committee is going to take that into consideration, especially if it's against quality competition, and even more so if it's away from home. So while mathematically, yes, the scoring margin is capped at 10, we always look at – the committee always looks at that subjectively, and especially if there's a pattern there where a team clearly is just dominating its opposition on a night-in, night-out basis.
And you know what, Dave, I kind of going off of that same question, the committee has the full schedule for each team and the scores of every game. Do you find that they look more at those individual who you played and what the score was and did you win or lose, or are they looking more at some of these metrics? I know last year the team sheets added in things like the Ken Palms and the Sagarins and the BPI and everything right on the team sheets. Are those more weighted or less weighted, or is it kind of a combination, or does it depend on the committee member itself?
It is a combination, and certainly all of it is factored in. It does come down to committee member preference. I think at the root of the evaluation process, people want to know, who did you play, where did you play, and how did you do? But at the same time, if you're looking at metrics, which, you know, all of them do, you're really looking at outliers. If, you know, if the KPI and the BPI and Sagarin all have a team in the 30s, but Ken Palm has them at 13, you know, the committee member is going to either ask me or Dan Gavitt, you know, why is that? Or those who are really astute with the metrics will figure it out themselves or attempt to figure it out themselves and try to see what, you know, what is the reason for that outlier. And sometimes it might be just the example we just talked about can often come into play is if a team is really dominating its competition, you know, and winning by high scoring margins. And in some metrics, you know, especially those predictive ones, that could come into play and that could result in having a higher ranking one metric versus, you know, some of the other ones we look at.
Well, you know, we mentioned, John mentioned that net rankings. I guess in past years, the RPI and how it's calculated have been pretty public. My understanding of this new, it's a new metric just this year, the net. It's more of a metric that's going to be released, I think, on a daily basis as the season goes on, but it's not, is it going to be out there for people to try to figure out themselves how it's calculated, or is it like, is it a combination of some of these other metrics, or is it an own system that you developed there with the NCAA?
Yeah, it's its own system, and, right. You know, it we will make it available just like the RPI. I think, you know, we partnered with Google Cloud to help develop this, and, you know, I think there's, you know, there's optimism that, you know, we'll release this at the end of November, which is what we typically do with the RPI, either, you know, early December, late November, and we're still planning on doing that, and then we'll update it on a daily basis. But you're absolutely right in that there isn't a formula. Like the RPI had a formula, and, you know, 25% this, 50% this, 25% this. We were transparent about it, and so people were able to, you know, figure it out, you know, pretty quickly and mimic it, and that's completely fine because that's all part of being transparent. We're going to be as transparent as possible about this, but with the understanding that this is machine learning, it's obviously clearly in its infant stages. You know, we're going to see how it's worked. We obviously tested previous data to get to the level of comfort that we're ready to go with it for the 2018-19 season. You know, there are five components for the net, and we have what's called a team value index, which is, you know, an algorithm that's set up to reward teams who beat other good teams and who beat other good teams. And so, yeah, it's results oriented. It's a results oriented component of the net. And I think that's what makes the net more modern, contemporary than the RPI is that there are characteristics of it that are predictive and while still, you know, using results, but the opponent and the location and obviously winning the game will factor into that to give a team team value index score. And then we're going to use, you know, average net efficiency. And so taking an defensive efficiency formula and coming up with a net efficiency. And by the way, that the efficiency rating won't be capped. And so, you know, that the committee will have actual data, whereas the scoring margin is capped, the efficiency won't be. Winning percentage, obviously, and adjusted winning percentage for rewarding teams for performing well on a neutral court, and even more so on a road court, a true road environment, and also penalizing for home losses. And then, as we mentioned, the scoring margin capped at 10 points. And this is Division I games only, we should point out, so any non-Division I opponent is not really factored into this. And then the other thing that's worth pointing out with the scoring margin is any overtime game or multiple overtime game, from a mathematics standpoint, even if the game is decided by 13 points, will be considered a 1-point loss for the team that lost the game, and a 1-point win for the victor. Yeah.
I like that. And just I'm about to make a very Mr. Obvious type of assessment here. The RPI was a very general rating, and I know that a lot of people said that it was inaccurate, but I'm like, well, it wasn't supposed to be a precise power ranking. It was just supposed to kind of give you a general idea, and all of the subjective stuff from watching the games and all of the other metrics would come into play. I and I don't know, maybe there isn't just, this might be a loaded question, but why do you think there was the need to get away from something general to like a more precise power ranking that almost does more of the thinking for them?
Well, I think it just came down to the fact that the committee, and it's not just the current members of the committee, but just in the last few years, I think just reached the point of conclusion that look, the RPI was developed in 1981, and it's, and at least for men's basketball, it's run its course from the standpoint that that others, you know, the Jeff Sagarins and Ken Palmroys and others of the world have come up with something that's just more modernized. And so to not use it, just, I don't want to say is not responsible, but it just makes more sense to use something that I think everyone from coaches to our fans, to the media, to the analytics community, which, you know, I follow a lot of people on Twitter who are, you know, deeply involved with analytics, not just at the basketball level, but with everything. And sure, I think some of those people would have you believe that analytics are everything. I happen to believe in the middle. I believe that there's a subjective part of this. And while the analytics can certainly help frame discussion and decisions as well, I don't think you can completely rely on them to solve every problem. So, you know, I'll probably get criticized for saying that from the analytics community, but that's my opinion, and others share it as well. But this all started, you know, a couple of years ago by, you know, the National Association of Basketball Coaches saying, look, you know, we're referencing all these other metrics, and we're trying to, you know, reference the RPI, schedule games so that we have, you know, good RPI ratings. But since these are out there, why not use it? And so the timing of that and, you know, just coincided with, you know, having Dan Gavitt on board, and he had a desire to do this as well. And so we've just been exploring it pretty heavily the last couple of years, and finally reached a point this summer we were ready to say that, you know, we're full go for this year.
Let me ask you, Dave, I mean, in the past, we've kind of looked at things like the RPI and the KPI as more of a results-based metric, while Ken Palm and Sagarin were more of predictive metrics. Is this net a kind of a hybrid of the two, or is it more of a predictive metric than, or can we classify it really?
I think you can classify it as a hybrid of the two. I think there's characteristics of the predictive nature, such as efficiency ratings and scoring margin. But as I mentioned, it is results based because you do have to prove you can beat quality teams, and you know, beat quality teams or capable of beating quality teams, and location is going to matter, and those sort of things. You know, last year we put in the quadrant system on the team sheets.
Big fan of that.
Yeah, we thought it certainly helped teams, you know, teams that aren't able to get a Duke or a Kentucky or a Kansas to come to their gym, have a chance to get, you know, quadrant wins. Because if you look at the top 75 teams in last year's RPI, there's a lot of teams from conferences, you know, big, medium, and small, that were in there. And if you win one on the road there, and those games are a lot easier to get on your schedule. Like if you're able to play Ryder in a home and home, you have an opportunity to get a quadrant one win if you beat Ryder on the road, for example. And there's plenty of comparable teams like that. And right. You know, they all matter. Now, you know, is beating Ryder at home when they're ranked 70th, you know, versus beating Villanova at home when they're ranked 3rd, are they the same? No, of course they're not the same. They're in the same quadrant, but that doesn't mean they're valued the same. So we want to be clear on that. But yeah, at the same time, it does broaden the net for, you know, road games and neutral games, and shrinks it for those home games, and hopefully makes teams, you know, want to challenge themselves in their schedule, especially in the non-conference schedule, you know, the portion of it where they have some control of who they play.
Yeah. And John, I think you had something else you wanted to.
So, David, you mentioned Villanova. That's a perfect segue to my question. So, one of the many, many, many stats you tweet out that I found to be fascinating was that This past year was the 11th in a row and 16 out of 17 where the defending champ did not advance past the Sweet 16 since Florida did it going back-to-back in 06-07. As Villanova is that defending champ, if you're allowed to make a prediction as to whether or not they're going to get past the Sweet 16, I'd love to hear it. If not, any thoughts on an explanation why we've had such a trend? Is it guys leaving early? Is it target on the back? Is it something else?
I think it's all of those. I mean, in terms of predictions, I would never predict against Coach Wright. You know, just them being in the Final Four, you know, a few times, 2009, I think, in Detroit, and then twice in the last 3 years, of course. You know, just having the opportunity to work not only with Coach Wright, but the staff and the administration of Villanova, they're just incredibly cooperative, and so they're easy to root for. They play a good, exciting brand of basketball, and you know, Coach Wright's a tremendous coach, and when you win championships, you tend to get good players, and they have some coming back with some experience from their national championship runs. I definitely wouldn't put it past them on, you know, cutting that, going all the way to say they could cut down the nets again. I know there are some other teams that will have plenty to say about that. But I think in terms of why, I think, I think there's tremendous parity in basketball. And it's a dangerous word because if you look at who wins the national championship, Jay Billis, will tell you there's not parity in college basketball, and he makes some good points about that. And because if you look at the national champions, it reads like a who's who of college basketball royalty, and I get that. But at the same time, it's not a coincidence. Just in the tenure that I've been associated with this championship, the teams that have made the Final Four, forget the Cinderella wins on the first weekend, which everybody loves, but just advancing all the way to the Final Four with, Wichita State before they were really Wichita State, when they were, still in the Missouri Valley and somewhat of an unknown to right. people.
Didn't know what was crazy about that is that I thought they had a much better team the year before and the year after.
Yeah.
But they won that everything just kind of lined up right for them in that tournament.
That's exactly right. And then, the George Masons and the VCUs and the, Butler before, Butler became Butler. And then obviously most recently, Loyola, Chicago. I mean, there's, I think, a fascinating case is Syracuse in the sense that you don't have to be a Cinderella to be a Cinderella, so to speak. You have a team that's one of the top 15 or so programs in the history of the game, and they're obviously from a Power Five conference. But at the same time, they've managed to make a couple of Final Four runs in the last 5 years or so that were, certainly unexpected from a seeding standpoint. And it just goes to show you, it's the beauty of the tournament. You get hot at the right time. Maybe someone gets upset and it clears your path a little easier, or maybe you just get hot and have good matchups. And it's not a 3 out of 5. It's a win or go home scenario. And in 40 minutes, anything can happen.
Yeah, Dave, one of the shows that we do each week once the season starts is called Under the Radar, which is what it sounds like. We talk about the 22 non-multi-bid leagues or non-regular multi-bid leagues. I know everybody starts out at zero, and in theory, if the SWAC gets out there and wins 70% of their out-of-conference games, they're going to be a multi-bid league. But, when you're looking at those – the teams that come out of those and the fan bases there seems to be this mindset that the committee is against them. I do not think it's that, but I do think that there is a circumstantial disadvantage that a lot of those teams have. Like if you're UNC Greensboro or Wright State or South Dakota State, who you would think would be pretty good this year, they essentially have a 5 or 6 week window to schedule and win the types of games that are going to impress the committee, whereas if you're in a Power Five conference, you're not confined to that. Has the committee ever discussed that, looked at that, and maybe you hate to think that teams would be measured differently, but has it ever come up that maybe we should reward this team because they tried to schedule or they had to play 4 road games in a 9-day period just to get those games on the schedule? Has the committee ever discussed that? I guess is I'm talking over in circles here, but I think you know what I mean.
Absolutely, and for one thing, you have to understand the committee makeup. Legislatively, it has to. We have to have representation.
Yes, and that's a good point. It's predominantly,
So the committee members, for example, Janet Cohn is the director of athletics at UNC Asheville, and Chris Reynolds is the AD at Bradley. So, those folks are represented. We have the Southland Conference Commissioner Tom Burnett on the committee, and so on and so forth. And so, you have that mixture of people with who come from different size conferences and schools, and so that comes up a lot. And the NCAA can't get into the business of scheduling or mandating scheduling.
Oh, can you try and find a way to that?
I would love to if President Emmert and the board of directors made me king for a day. I mean, one of the things I would do would be. Every team has got to play a true road game against. I would put the conferences say like in three, columns that you have to play a true road game against one team from each of these three columns. And so, if you're Elon, one year Duke's going to have to come play at your gym, and how great of experience that would be for their fans and obviously their players and their program. Because you have to do that. So it would be nice. At the same time, it's not realistic. And right. We do try to, the committee's charged with picking the best 36 teams. And if challenge themselves out of the conference and have some success and do it, not do it exclusively at home. You like to think they're going to, get the benefit of getting a bid. The AQ system is something that each conference, determines on an annual basis. And obviously now every conference determines its automatic qualifier by virtue of winning the conference tournament. And those conference tournaments they sure are a lot of fun, but those teams that go 15-1 in the league and have a great year and then get upset early in their conference tournament. It's just cringeworthy every year.
Yeah.
Just as someone who's been a basketball fan since I was, as young as I can remember, I'm 48 years old and my earliest college basketball memories really are before even Magic and Larry in 79 when I wasn't quite 9 years old. And just growing up, loving the sport and getting to do this and live out my dream is tremendous. But if there's one thing I don't like is seeing those results, come in during conference tournament week.
Right.
You go down.
And we can relate to that. Like we always say, like a good upset is a team that might be flying under the radar. That's really good. And that gets to prove it in the NCAA tournament. A bad one is when the most deserving team doesn't win. But as you know, the business side of it, those conferences like to play those tournaments because they're money makers, and a lot of times their television deal is attached to it. So without the conference tournament, they wouldn't even get the regular season games on TV that they do, which for those smaller under-the-radar leagues, as we call them, I don't like the term mid-major, by the way, but
I don't either.
Yeah, those type of conferences, that's a big deal, but it is hard. Because, again, as you know, like a lot of the Power Five conferences, they'll play the home guarantee games and they'll play showcase neutral site games that are generally scheduled by a third party. And the third parties that put those types of events together aren't interested in Wright State and South Dakota State like we are.
Right.
So it's really hard because you have 6 weeks at the beginning to get those games. But it's nice to know that the committee is at least tuned into that.
It is. And, it's, we're following the committee. And, those of us who there's a handful of us who are helping to evaluate teams. We have staff meetings where we talk about it, all the teams. And I remember my first year, in 2006, the very first staff meeting I went to, where we were, you know, going around the room, going conference by conference, talking about teams, and obviously the conversations that involve the Big Ten or the Pac-12 generally take longer to wrap up than conferences like the South one. But I remember the first time I established any credibility was in my first year in 2006, when our vice president at the time was Tom Jernstedt, and Tom said, all right, Southland Conference, what do we think? And everyone's like, yeah, one bid league, whoever wins the conference tournament. And this is, of course, in you know, mid-January probably. Yeah. They're like, the consensus was whoever wins the conference tournament is going to be the only team from the Southland, you know, represented in the NCAA tournament. And so someone said, yeah, one bid league. And I said, yeah, it's a one bid league, but Northwestern State's going to be a 14 seed, and I feel sorry for the 3 seed they have to play.
Yeah.
They won that game, right?
Iowa, and it was a 14-3, and one of the staff members was an Iowa grad, so it really stung him even more. And so immediately I started getting texts and instant messages like, well, you nailed that. You know, and it was like a prediction 2 months out in advance that, you know, it's one of those where you throw 20 darts, one of them is going to hit. So that was that was that. But and it's those, you can tell those teams are really good. You know, this year, I thought, Vermont was going to be one of those teams. Vermont,
yeah.
I thought they would give someone fits, and of course they lose at the buzzer, and you know what happens from there. So UMBC goes on and pulls one of the biggest upsets in tournament history. So,
right.
But I thought Vermont was going to be a tough out for somebody, and for a 2 seed or a 3 seed, and they just
lost in the
buzzer. John, and I'll throw it back to you.
Sure, it's funny you're talking about Elon Duke. I would say set up the GoFundMe page to get Virginia to play at UMBC. We'll make $1 million. I agree.
I believe actually isn't North Carolina going to Wofford this year, who beat them last year? So there's a little bit of that that does go on.
North Carolina is one of those programs where they will go out and play a North Iowa on the road, and
they're one of the two or three. Virginia does it. Whiskey does it. Right. That's about it.
So we're, I believe, 2 weeks away exactly from a new rule change on October 15th, where players who want to transfer to a different school no longer need to ask their school for permission. They can just put their names in the transfer database after announcing their intention and then get contacted by other schools. My question, what impact do you think it's going to have? Obviously, nobody knows for sure. I assume it's not going to be a crazy, chaotic scene, but I think it will increase the number of transfers. And part B, you think it's a good rule or that it's a catch-all? Because my understanding is that conferences are allowed to make more restrictive rules, so that if the Big Ten wants to say, well, that's a great rule, NCAA, we're going to do our own thing, is it still worth having the rule?
Yeah, unfortunately, guys, I can't really comment on that because that's more of a legislative type thing, and our public and media relations staff is the one more appropriate to comment on that particular topic or anything from a legislative standpoint. I'm sorry about that.
No, I'll do an easier one then. Who's going to win the AL wildcard game?
Well, you're talking to a lifelong Yankees fan, so doesn't sound like you guys are supportive of that. So, the Yankees fans are basically either with us or without us. But I was born in upstate New York and to a family of Yankee fans, and while I haven't lived in upstate New York since I was, 6 years old, so 1976, to give you a time reference, I've really never changed favorite teams. I've always been a Bills, Sabres, and Yankees fan. I've been loyal to them. There's been plenty of times where I wish I wasn't a Bills and Sabres fan.
Well, the Yankees kind of offset that.
Dave, I'm from Albany, New York myself, natively. Oh, okay. But I have to say I've been living in southern New Jersey for years now, and I've completely converged all the Philadelphia teams.
Well, you've had a pretty good run with Villanova.
Yes, we have.
Eagles, and, the Bills had the Minnesota game last week and crashed back down to earth yesterday. But, yeah, I've those are my teams. I've always, you know, stayed true to them. And so I'm not a bandwagon Yankee fan. So I will definitely be pacing on Wednesday night. My kids are both, they both love the Yankees. Their rooms are both floor to ceiling with all Yankee stuff.
So, wow.
I told them they can like any team they want in any sport except for baseball. They have to like the Yankees. They don't mind. I took them to Yankee Stadium for the first time this year, and there was a rain out Friday, so we had to do a day-night doubleheader Saturday, and you'd think having kids that young, that would be a problem, but they were into it from start to finish. It was a fun experience.
I personally have one other question. This has been one of the most important things I've ever thought about when it comes to the committee and March and the whole process there is, what's the food like in the committee room? Really? I mean, that's.
I tell you what, there are two times when it's just impossible. I've always been a big guy and I think is August 6th was the day I started Weight Watchers, almost 2 months, and I've lost nearly 30 pounds. And
oh, wow.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So I'll probably put them all back on in March, but I'm going to try not to. During the selection week, you know, we go out, we leave the room, the hotel, especially the last few years we've been in New York. There's a great little Italian restaurant here in Indianapolis, and we've had selections there.
That's infamous. The pasta place.
It is. It's a great place. Yeah. And in New York, we've gone out for, you know, the last few years, we've gone out for a great steak and seafood place. And then, in the selection room, we have pretty good meals and a lot of ice cream. The ice cream buffets. Comes in, you know, probably three different.
Yeah, I thought the ice cream buffet was a myth, but I guess it's
real.
Completely true. And, you know, my obesity shows it. So, and then I tell you the place, you know, since we signed with Turner in 2011, and I've only done this, I think, the last at least 3 years, maybe four, but we go to Atlanta. When I say we, it's J.D. Collins, who's our national coordinator for officiating, Ron English, who's our director of game management on the men's basketball staff, Dan Gavitt, myself, and Julie Kimmons, who's our director of broadcasting, and then Abby Newell is also on the basketball staff. And so the six of us go to Turner Studios, and they set us up in this little control center where we have all the games from the first four on Tuesday, Wednesday, and then Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we're in this, you know, room with all the TVs and all the games going on. We're watching every game, flipping the audio. If we see anything controversial, you know, we have the chair of the committee in the room every year, along with the national coordinator, and then I draft up a statement if necessary. We prep JD to go on the air with the Turner CBS folks. And during that time, the Turner people feed us one meal after another from the best restaurants in Atlanta. And it's like they're bringing us food nonstop. We have two incredible meals a day. And then on Sunday, you know, the last day, the opening weekend, they have like an omelet station and waffles and everything. It's just, it is insane. And we eat like kings. And it is, it is a 5,000 calorie a day.
We recreate that scene here with the televisions, but we're eating frozen pizza and things like that.
I've been there and I've enjoyed it myself. It's to a whole new level. If I ever leave this job, I don't know what I would do with myself during selection weekend.
Join Hoops HD. We replicate the process each week and all that. So
count me in.
Okay,
John, just something else.
Yeah, just all this talk about ice cream and frozen pizza reminds me that we're going to be going to Minnesota in April for the Final Four. I certainly don't hate the state. I have three great nephews and a sister there, and I'm going there Thanksgiving next month. But do we have to do the Final Four in Minnesota?
Well, we do this year, and it's going to be great. You know, as a resident of Indianapolis for the last 17 years, I can tell you, 5 years or so ago, everyone was dreading the Super Bowl coming to Indianapolis and how cold it was going to be in, you know, late January, early February, I guess it was. And I mean, it was 65 degrees the entire week. And so our prediction is that in Minneapolis, obviously it won't be late January, thankfully, because then that prediction won't come true. But especially this year, with this is the late as the Final Four can be, is April 6th and 8th, and that's the dates for this year's Final Four. So as we're approaching the second week in April, I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's going to be, you know, 55, 60 degrees and be very pleasant in downtown Minneapolis. And just in case it's not, there's plenty of, you know, indoor walking area to get from place to place downtown. So I think they say they have, you know, the largest indoor walking in a downtown space in any city in America or something like that. So, well, we will all manage one way or the other. That will be fine.
All right. Anything else from David Briggs?
No, I think I got all my questions. Well, one more. One more comment. This might be, I've for years said that I think that there should be one person in charge of all of this, and I think that that person should be me. any thoughts, feelings about that? Is there any movement at the NCAA that could result in that happening?
Well, let's see, tomorrow morning, bright and early, I'm actually making a brief presentation to the Championships Oversight Committee, so I will bring that up.
Oh, great. Okay.
We've got it good then, huh?
Yeah.
I guess then, David, I want to thank you for joining us. It's really been a great discussion, I thought, and very informative.
Well, good. I appreciate you guys having me on. And when, you know, David, when you were emailing me last night and telling me about, you know, the background with you guys, and yeah. I thought it was hilarious. I as the kids say, I LOL'd.
Yeah.
So I thought it was hilarious, and it sounds like something that, you know, I'd be doing with my buddies, and it's great that you guys have that friendship and
yeah,
and do that type of thing. I think it's neat. And, you know, and the thing is, you know, we love our diehard college basketball fans. We know that especially early in the season, our sport can get overshadowed by, you know, the college and professional football game, and those are great sports, and you know, I'm fans of both of them, but you know, to me, the, you know, nothing beats college basketball, and it's
yeah,
passionate fans from yourself. Yeah,
I agree with that, and maybe it's my imagination, but the last two, because we used to mope about that constantly, just how it took so long for the ball to get rolling, but the last couple of years we've had some really good, it seems like the interest kicks in earlier.
It is.
I don't know. Maybe it's my imagination. But.
I think there used to be one or two of these tournaments that would, you know, capture everyone's imagination, you know, for a little while. But now,
yeah,
so many more of these Thanksgiving tournaments that are, you know, pop up, and you know, whether it's in the Bahamas or Orlando or Anaheim, or as obviously in New York, they have a lot of college basketball games. But also just, you know, just the. Something like the Legends Classic, where, you know, where you have programs like Kansas and Kentucky and Duke and Michigan State competing against each other, and you know, some of our heavyweight schools like Carolina and Kansas, Kentucky, you know, they're not afraid to schedule anybody and play all over right. the place. And then you know, you still have the, you know, the preseason NIT is still a draw, and the Gavitt Games is still a draw, and you know, locally here, I love the annual clash between, you know, Purdue, Notre Dame, Indiana, and Butler, right?
Yeah, and you just wish more teams would do that. Like, that's such a great showcase. And, like, you have so many – I don't want to say rivalries because they don't play, but you have so many feuds that would become rivalries if Kansas and Wichita would play or something like that.
Yeah, I think the best thing that came out of the conference realignment mm-hmm. was that some of the schools wanted to – keep their, you know, keep their connections with one another. I mean, like, growing up as a teenager in the 80s, in my mind, especially, you know, being, you know, from Central New York, there wasn't anything bigger than Syracuse, Georgetown.
Yeah.
So see them play every year is, mm-hmm. I mean, that's, and now it's a non-conference game, obviously, but it still means a lot to those fan bases, and And those are the type of games you just want to keep alive. So all those teams that are, you know, I think UConn is playing Syracuse this year. So those are the type of games you want to keep alive. And I'd love to see, you know, Texas A&M and Texas play. I'd love to see Arkansas and Texas play. I'd love to see, you know, Indiana and Kentucky get that thing going back again. You know,
Kansas and Missouri. That's a running joke on our show.
I'd love Gonzaga to start playing, you know, any of the Pac-12 schools.
Regularly.
It just enhances the game. And when it's just more of those marquee games in November and December, it creates more buildup for the tournament, and it's healthy for the sport.
Yeah.
Well, David, do want to thank you again for joining us, and absolutely, if you want to
welcome,
if you want to give us a call, like on March 16th and 17th, let's know exactly who's in or out. We definitely would not say no to that. No,
that is a job security thing.
Yeah. I can do. But no, if you do want to ever come back on again, we'd love to have you back. It's been a great conversation. I thought. Yeah. I do want to thank you again for joining us.
So thank you guys for having me. I really had a lot of fun.
All right.
Thanks a lot. And thanks for everybody for listening. And we'll be back again soon.